that we read, the enemies of Jesus ask for a sign in verse 38 of Matthew chapter 12. And Jesus' response is that the only sign they would receive would be the sign of the prophet Jonah. We used Jonah as a text for the lesson a couple of weeks ago. We talked about chapter 4 in particular, about the attitude of Jonah toward those who were, in his eyes, the enemies of God's people. He didn't want them to be saved. When God did relent, change his mind about destroying the city of Nineveh, Jonah chapter 4 and verse 1 tells us that that made Jonah angry. But I want to go back to chapter 1 in the book of Jonah this morning as a basis for not only this morning's lesson, but for the one tonight as well. Both this morning and tonight we're going to be talking about the same theme. There's an incredible story in Jonah chapter 1. It's incredible, I think, to all of us, but especially if you are interested in teaching the gospel to other people. And you've tried to do that. You've tried to share the gospel with other people, and you've known the frustration of people rejecting that teaching. As a matter of fact, you have undoubtedly, if you've tried to share the gospel with other people, known that rejection more commonly or more often than you've seen success. The vast majority of people who we try to touch and influence with the gospel reject the message for any number of reasons. Men spend their whole lives as preachers of the gospel, dedicated to converting souls, saving souls. And at the end of many years, 30 or 40 or 50 or perhaps even more years than that of preaching the gospel, can count maybe hundreds, and perhaps, depending on the circumstances, there might be thousands, but certainly not any more than that, successes that they've seen in the conversion of lost souls. And so again, it's not just something that preachers experience, but something that all of us experience from time to time. What we have in Jonah chapter 1 is, I think, the most successful meeting that, the most successful preaching that ever occurred in the history of the world. We're more impressed, I think, with the preaching that the apostles did in Acts chapter 2, but the fact of the matter is 3,000 is nothing compared to the conversion of the entire city of Nineveh. About 700 years or so, somewhere between 700 and 800 years before Christ was born. The scholars tell us that at this period in its history, it was a very large and very important city, occupied by several hundred thousand people. Even conservative estimates suggest that the population of the city of Nineveh in the 8th century B.C. would have been 300,000 people. And Jonah walks into that city and he preaches. And after one day, the text tells us that the city was a large city, 3 days' journey. I take that to mean that if you were walking across the city of Nineveh, it would have taken you 3 days to accomplish that. And he's only been in the city for a day, and already he's seen incredible results. The people are believing the things that he's preaching. And what we end up with by the time we get to the end of Jonah chapter 1 is that this entire city, from the poorest to the most insignificant and unimportant person in the city all the way up to the king, believe the message of Jonah. And they do what Jonah had instructed them to do. They repent. And they appeal to Jehovah. They appeal to the Lord of the Israelites, the God of the world, to spare them, to relent from his threat to destroy the city. The threat had been that if they refused to repent, that God would destroy the city after 40 days. And I would suggest to you that, again, that is an amazing story. It's so amazing, as a matter of fact, that skeptics have doubted the validity of the story of Jonah from the very beginning, almost. Not just because of the story of the great fish, in whose belly he spent 3 days and three nights, according to the text. And that's the reference that Jesus makes in the reading that we shared together a few minutes ago. Give us a sign. The only sign you're getting is the sign of the Son of Jonah. Just like he was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. That's all you're getting. But Jesus confirms, I think, the historicity of this story. in the book of Jonah by giving that as the sign in Matthew chapter 12. He doesn't refer to it as a fable. He quotes it or references it as something that really happened. And what I wonder, and what I have wondered for a long time, just down through the years, and have turned this over in my mind and contemplated in this, how did that happen? I mean, how did that happen? What would there have been about the message that Jonah preached? And it's really a simple message. There's not much that's said about what he exactly what it was that he said to these people. You just go into the city and proclaim to them that if they don't repent, I'm going to destroy this city in 40 days. What is there about the message that would have produced such unbelievable, almost unbelievable results so that the whole city repents? Lots of attempts to answer that question by scholars. The simplest explanation, I suppose, and the easiest explanation would be that it's a demonstration of the power of the Word of God. And I certainly wouldn't refute that claim at all. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. And so certainly this story in Jonah of his preaching in chapter 3 is the account of the actual preaching and the conversion of the city. It is an incredible demonstration of the power of God, but that by itself doesn't answer this question. I mean, what is there about this story that makes this preaching so effective? And how is it that it takes effect so quickly? So that within just a few days, the entire city repents. And at the end of 40 days, God has relented. God has changed His mind. I want to share something with you that I've thought about for a long time. And what I'm about to share with you is just something that I've thought about. The text doesn't answer this question. It just asserts the fact that it happened. And again, Jesus documents that. He confirms the authenticity of this story by referencing Jonah on more than one occasion in the Gospels. So the text doesn't really tell us, but I thought a lot about what is it that causes this to happen. And again, in Jonah chapter 1, I want you to notice, you're familiar, we don't have time to read all of this, but you're familiar with the story. God commissions him to go to Jonah. He goes the opposite direction. He goes down to Joppa. He lived in northern Palestine. He goes down to Joppa, which was a seaport. He catches a boat that is going to Tarshish. That's modern-day Spain, I think, probably. He's trying to get all the way on the other side of the Mediterranean Sea from where he lived. He's trying to get a long way away from God. A storm comes up. They determine after a period of time that Jonah is the cause of it. And he doesn't deny it. He even tells them that he's on their ship because he's trying to run away from the God who's causing the storm. And so they ask, what do we do about this? How do we fix this? How do we solve this problem? And Jonah very candidly tells them, the only chance you've got of surviving this is you've got to throw me into the Mediterranean Sea. You've got to throw me overboard. To their credit, they didn't want to do that. They try to row to get the boat back into shore, but God's not going to let that happen. And so they pray to God. They ask God, don't hold us guilty. Don't hold us accountable for what we're about to do. And they pick him up and they throw him into the sea. And the storm stops. And the text tells us that Jonah was swallowed by the fish and stayed in the stomach of the fish, verse 17 of chapter 1, for 3 days and three nights. Let me suggest to you, again, trying to answer this question. As far as these sailors are concerned, Jonah is dead. And the fact of the matter is, that's exactly the conclusion that you would have come to had you been on the ship. You're in a severe storm. I don't know if you're in sight of land or not, but it really doesn't matter. You can't get to the land. And the last that they see of Joseph is he's being sucked under the surface of the Mediterranean Sea, and they don't ever see him again. And the text says that he was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. What I've wondered down through the years is this. I've wondered what happened to the ship. I know, I'm relatively certain that they didn't continue their voyage to Tarshish. I have a hard time saying that. Tarshish. You got to get the sounds in there. And the reason, if I were in a Bible class, I would ask this question, and some clever person would know the answer. Why would they not have just gone on to Tarshish? Because they threw the cargo that they were taking to Tarshish overboard to lighten the ship for the storm. My guess is they turned around and went right back to Palestine. They went right back to Joppa. And what I'm wondering is this. I'm wondering how long, when they got to Joppa, maybe the same day that they threw Jonah overboard, how long would it have taken the word of this incident to start spreading inland? We had a guy on our ship. His name was Jonah. He was a Hebrew. And he was running away from God. And we threw him into the sea. And he disappeared. I don't know if they saw the fish or not. No indication in Jonah chapter 1 that they saw the fish, but they might have. But as soon as we threw him overboard, the storm stopped, just exactly like he said it was going to. My guess is that that's the kind of story that's going to spread pretty quickly. Nineveh is an important trade city. As a matter of fact, there was a road that ran directly from Joppa to the city of Nineveh. A very significant, a very important trade route. And what I'm wondering is this. Did the story of what happened on that ship get to the city of Nineveh before Jonah did? And if it did, what they heard was that Jonah was dead. And all of a sudden, a man walks into the gates of the city and says, "I am Jonah, the son of Amittai, and I'm here with a message from God." Wait a minute. This guy was dead. This is the guy that the sailors tell us they threw into the sea. He had to have drowned. He could not possibly be alive. Now go back to the text in Matthew chapter 12 that we read together just a few minutes ago. What I'm suggesting to you is that I think possibly, you know, could I prove this? Would I bet my life on it? Not at all. But I think it's entirely likely that it was the appearance of a man that they thought was dead, who now is in their city alive, that gives the message the power that it has to convert the entire city. Again, all the way up to the king. In other words, resurrection. Back in our text, in Matthew chapter 12, when Jesus answers this question, he answers this request, "Give us a sign. We would see a sign from you." His response is, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here." Something greater than Jonah. What was among them that was greater than Jonah? It was Jesus himself. And I think what Jesus is saying is this. If you think it's incredible that Jonah was thrown into the Mediterranean Sea and that he somehow or another survived in the belly of a fish for 3 days and three nights and was vomited out onto the beach and made an appearance several days later in the city of Nineveh, and they saw a man they believed to have been dead, but now he is alive. And the reason he's alive is because of the power of God. Only God could have saved his life. Only God could have kept him alive. Let me tell you, you're about to see something greater than that. Something, he doesn't say someone, he says something, but something greater than Jonah is here. You are about to witness something more significant and more powerful and more incredible even than the story of Jonah. Because Jonah didn't really die. He just appeared to be dead. The Son of Man will die. And he will be in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. And he will be raised from the dead. I think that's likely, in part at least, what Paul had in mind in Romans chapter 1, when he talks about the power of the gospel. And what is it that gives the gospel its power? If I were to ask that question, be turning to Romans chapter 1. We're going to look at a passage here in just a second. But let me ask it. If I were asking a question, just not necessarily to this group, but to a group of spiritually minded people in general. What is it that gives the gospel its power? My guess is that the vast majority of people in the world would say it is the cross that gives the gospel its power. I think that would be the standard answer. I think that would be the universal answer. It is the, of course, it is the cross that gives the gospel its power. It is true that we come together on the first day of every week to remember the cross, to focus our attention on the cross, the death of Christ on the cross. But the fact of the matter is, it is not the cross that gives the gospel its power. The cross wasn't anything unusual in the first century. Thousands of people in the first century died on crosses. As a matter of fact, on the very day Jesus was nailed to the cross, two thieves were nailed to crosses on either side of him. The Israelites in the first century, the Romans in the first century, the foreigners who might have been in Jerusalem in the first century, when they saw three crosses up on the hill, they would not have thought a thing about that. You saw that kind of thing all the time. Nothing unique about the cross. And yet the cross has come, in modern times, the cross has come to mean something to people in general, I think, that it never would have meant to people in the first century. There was no glory in the cross. To die on the cross was the most shameful way that a person could die. It's inconceivable that Jews or Romans or Christians in the first century would have had jewelry constructed in the appearance of a cross and wear it like some kind of swag demonstration of their faith in some way or another. The cross was embarrassing. It was shameful. It was humiliating. It was intended to be that. And the Bible doesn't say that it is the cross that gives the God. The cross was necessary. The cross was essential. It was absolutely essential that Christ die. And again, we come together on the first day of every week to remember that. But look at Romans chapter 1, where the Apostle Paul says the thing that gives the gospel its power is what happened 3 days later. Not the cross. Jesus wasn't the only one to die on a cross. Even on the day he died, he wasn't the only one to die on a cross. But I promise you this, 3 days later, he was the only one who wasn't in his tomb. And so Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, talking about Christ, concerning his son who was born of a descendant of David according to the flesh, verse 3, who was declared the Son of God with power. How, Paul? By the resurrection from the dead, according to the Spirit of holiness, Jesus Christ our Lord. What is it that gives the gospel its power? What did Jesus mean when he said something greater than Jonah is here? As remarkable as it is that Jonah spent 3 days and three nights in the belly of a fish and lived to tell about it and actually made an appearance in Nineveh, and I think that's part of the power of the preaching of Jonah in the city of Nineveh. We thought you were dead. You should have been dead. The fact that you're still alive must say something about the God you serve. Jesus said you're going to see something greater than Jonah. You're going to see the Son of Man die and be entombed, be buried. And when the third day rolls around, you're going to see that the tomb will be empty. I want us to think for a few minutes this morning by way of introduction, and then to discuss this and attack this in a little bit more detail in the lesson tonight, Lord willing, I want us to think about the resurrection of Christ and the significance and the importance of the resurrection of Christ. The fact of the matter is, there are some people who would argue that the resurrection really doesn't matter, that it is unimportant. It would be wrong to say that the cross is unimportant or insignificant. It was prophesied that Jesus would die in a humiliating way. And that's exactly what happened. It was necessary for Jesus to die in that way. But what makes Jesus' story unique is not the death on the cross. Again, it is what happened 3 days later. It is the fact that he was raised from the dead. Josh McDowell, a number of years ago, wrote two volumes of a book. And Susan and I have given many of these away down through the years to high school and college students and others who were interested in evidences. McDowell has revised and updated this book and keeps it in print. Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's an excellent resource. And he says this about the resurrection, and I like this a lot. The resurrection of Jesus is one of the most wicked, vicious, heartless hoaxes ever foisted upon the minds of men, or it is the most fantastic fact of history. And that's exactly right. I mean, the fact that he died on the cross, again, other people died on the cross, even on the same day he died on the cross. But the fact that he rose from the dead on the third day, that is either the greatest hoax that has ever been perpetuated on human beings, or it is an incredible and remarkable and fantastic fact of history. It becomes essential. It becomes necessary. Essential is the right word. For us to come to grips at some point or another in our faith with the resurrection of Jesus. Paul said this about the resurrection. And he doesn't say this about the death. He says it about the resurrection. He doesn't say if Christ had not died, your faith is worthless. But what he does say is if Christ had not been raised, your faith is worthless. You are still in your sins. The cross without the resurrection would have just been an embarrassing and humiliating death. The kind of thing that would never have been discussed in polite company. But you add the resurrection to the death of Jesus on the cross, and it becomes the focal point of all of human history. From creation until the undetermined time in the future when God chooses to bring creation to an end, that becomes the focal point. Declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection of the dead. Paul said, if that didn't happen, then everything is vain. All we preach, all we talk about, it is all completely useless and worthless. H.P. Lydon, in a book that he wrote over 100 years ago, Therefore Stand, said, faith in the resurrection is the very keystone in the arch of Christian faith. Does everybody know what a keystone is? In an archway, what a keystone is. The keystone is the stone in the middle at the top that the arch attaches to on both sides. The arch in St. Louis has a keystone piece. And it was the last piece, if you've ever seen the television documentaries of the arch in St. Louis being constructed, the keystone was the last piece that they put in. It's the piece that holds everything together. If the keystone is weak, if the keystone fails, then that arch is falling down. Which is why, it's just the thought of that is why Susan never has been and never will be in the top of that arch. If the keystone fails, the arch falls. And notice that sometime. Maybe you see keystones all over Bowling Green. Maybe a window that has a masonry construction up the side of it. And then at the top, in some form or another, there's the keystone. That's what Lydon is talking about. Faith in the resurrection is the very keystone of the arch of Christian faith. And when it is removed, all must inevitably crumble to ruin. That's exactly right. If you can do away with the resurrection, you don't have to worry about the cross. And you don't have to worry about the miracles. And you don't have to worry about the teaching that Jesus did that's recorded. All you've got to do is you've got to do away with the resurrection. You take that away and the rest of it is gone. It all falls. Which is why, incidentally, skeptics and doubters and enemies of God and Christ have devoted such considerable time and attention and energy down through the centuries. To doing away with belief in the resurrection. Michael Green, this is a wonderful little book. It's been out of print, unfortunately, for a long time. Fewer than 100 pages. And I can't find my copy of it, by the way. Somebody out there have my copy of Man Alive? It has my name in it like 32 times, so I don't know where I've let it get away from me. But I have had this quote from the book that I've used in a number of lessons and Bible classes down through the years, where Michael Green says, Christianity stands or falls with the truth of the resurrection. And again, that's exactly right. It does not stand or fall based on the cross. I don't want you to misunderstand. I see some looks on people's faces like, you know, sounds like the preacher saying the cross is nothing. You've not heard me say that at all. I pointed at the table. I suggested that we come together on the first day of every week to remember the death of Christ. But what I'm saying to you is this. Why is that important? Why does the death of Christ mean something different than the death of either one of the thieves on either side of him? It is because of what happened 3 days later. It is because of the resurrection. That's why Paul would say in Romans chapter 1 that Jesus was declared to be the Son of God with power. He didn't say he was declared to be the Son of God with power because he died on a cross. And in 1 Corinthians 15, he doesn't say, if you can disprove the cross, if you can do away with the cross, then all of our preaching is vain. What makes the cross significant is the resurrection. And so Green is exactly right. Christianity stands or falls with the truth of the resurrection. Once disprove it, and you have disproved Christianity. And so what I would like to suggest to you this morning, and again, we're just kind of introduced the subject this morning, come back and talk about a few things in a little more detail tonight. It is absolutely essential that we come to grips with the resurrection of Christ, that that be the keystone of our faith. If he was raised from the dead, then everything matters. If he wasn't raised from the dead, then nothing matters. And the first thing I want to do is I want to think about the claims that Jesus made. I'm not going to take the time, because we don't have time this morning, to look at all of these. But Jesus made some astounding claims during his lifetime. For example, he claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to have been sent from the Father, for example, John chapter 6. Before Abraham was, I am, John chapter 8, he was calling himself God. He was claiming to be God. And every time Jesus does that, every time he makes that claim, he angers the Pharisees. As a matter of fact, it was his claim to be I am, before Abraham was I am, that started planting the idea in the Jews' minds. We need to kill this blasphemer. He's claiming to be the Son of God. But not only did Jesus claim to be the Son of God, Jesus very clearly claimed that he would be raised from the dead. We've already looked at Matthew chapter 12. Look at Mark chapter 8. We'll look at these other two passages quickly. In Mark chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. Jesus said, Mark says, he warned them, verse 30, he warned them to tell no one after Peter had said, you are the Christ. And then in verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And look what Mark says in verse 32. And he was stating the matter plainly. You know, he's at this point in time, he's not beating around the bush about this. I'm going to die and I'm coming back in 3 days. I'm going to be raised from the dead. You see the same thing in Luke chapter 9, verse 22. Where Jesus himself said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Jesus claimed that he was going to be raised from the dead. And so again, Green is exactly right. If you disprove the resurrection, if that didn't really happen, then Jesus was... Well, C.S. Lewis's trilemma, there'd be another great Bible class question. Well, what was the trilemma that was proposed by C.S. Lewis? It was about these claims that Jesus is making. He claimed to be God. He claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed that he was going to rise from the dead. There are only three possibilities. One of them is that he was a liar. That he knew he wasn't really God. And that he knew he wasn't really going to be raised from the dead. So he just lied about it. That's one possibility. Second possibility is that he was nuts. He was crazy. He was deluded. There are terms that would describe the psychological state of a person who believed that they were God, who believed that if you killed them, they would come back to life on the third day. And that's a possibility, that Jesus was that. The third possibility is that he was telling the truth, that he really was God, and that he really would raise from the dead. Actually, these two things are very intimately tied together. How does he prove that he is God? When they ask for a sign, give us a sign. The sign you'll get, Jesus said, is the resurrection. That's how you'll know I'm God. That's how you'll know who I really am, who I claimed to be. Now, incidentally, let me just say, those are the only three possibilities. When you hear people, and you hear this all the time, if you watch, especially if you watch those highfalutin channels like the History Channel or A&E or Discovery or National Geographic, you'll hear all the time people make the claim, well, Jesus, he was just a man, but he was a really good man and he was a really good teacher. No, he wasn't. He was either God or he was a liar or he was a lunatic. Those are the only three options you have. There's not a fourth option that somebody who could claim what Jesus claimed could not be a good person, could not be a righteous teacher. You have to settle on one of those three. And it won't do to try to kind of sanitize Jesus. And well, he was just a good man. He was just a good teacher. Again, that's not so. Jesus makes these claims, and he claims that he was going to be raised from the dead. What I want to do this morning, there are several questions that have to be dealt with. I'm going to skip one of them. The first question really is, did Jesus really live? Was there ever even really a man in the first century in Palestine named Jesus who lived or came from the city of Nazareth? And the fact of the matter is, for centuries, it was very common and very popular for people to deny that. Albert Schweitzer, a name that would be familiar to some people, I think. Albert Schweitzer wrote a book in the 1930s. The title of the book was The Quest for the Historical Jesus. And Schweitzer's conclusion was, at that time, it's a made-up person. Nobody ever by that name ever really lived. He's just like... Well, I started to say like, you know who. man, too many. I'm looking into the eyes of too many children. it's like that. It's like that. And that Jesus isn't really any different. Well, I'm looking into the eyes of some wide-eyed adults, too, now that I see that. But it's like that. But Schweitzer was wrong. There is abundant, extra-biblical evidence that a man named Jesus really did live in Palestine, and that he really died by the hands of Romans on a cross in about the year 33 A.D. I'll reserve that for another lesson. But let's assume that we've established that. There really was a man named Jesus who lived in the first century. The first question to deal with is, did he really die? Did he really die? And that becomes an important question because when you can't deny that he existed, then you have to start coming up with excuses. And one of the excuses is that he didn't really die. That his death was just a fake. Hugh Schoenfield wrote a book in 1965 called The Passover Plot. It was, by the way, amazingly to me, it was a runaway bestseller in the 1960s. And it remains in print. Schoenfeld contended that it was a plot. And I can't remember, I've read the book, but it's been a long time ago. I can't remember if Schoenfeld says Jesus was in on it or it was just part of a plot by his apostles. But they drugged him before he was nailed to the cross. And it appeared that he was dead. And they took him down and they didn't really bury him. They procured a corpse from someplace else and they buried that person instead. And that Jesus was spirited away and he recovered. And he lived in France or he lived in Spain. You hear stuff like that. Again, A&E, Discovery Channel, History Channel, you hear stuff like this all the time. He had a wife, Mary Magdalene, as a matter of fact. He had children. You hear those incredible stories. Well, that kind of thing comes up from time to time. It becomes important, if we're going to deal with the resurrection, we've got to, first of all, deal with the question, did Jesus die? So I want to do this, and then the lesson will be yours this morning. And then again, he lived, he died. We're going to have to look in the tomb. We'll do that tonight. But several things that would argue against a fake death having taken place. Number one, the intention of the Jews was to kill Jesus. We won't look at these passages, but Matthew 26, 27, John 19, their intention was to kill him. They didn't just want him punished. They didn't just want him humiliated. They wanted him dead. And so the gospel writers at least make it clear that their intention was to kill him. Number two, when you think about what he went through even prior to being put on the cross, and then you think about what we know medically, physiologically, about crucifixion. It is virtually inconceivable that someone could have had a 12-hour to 15-hour stretch of physical abuse like Jesus had and survive it. Just the loss of blood. The spear in his side and the bodily fluids that were released from his body would argue that Jesus died. The scourging and the crucifixion together combined make it extremely unlikely that the death had been fake. Perhaps if he had just been nailed to the cross without having been physically brutalized prior to being nailed to the cross, that argument would have a little more validity, would carry a little more punch. But you combine the scourging with the crucifixion and it lacks validity. All four gospel writers specifically say that Jesus was dead. So we have testimony. And two of these guys saw it with their own eyes. Matthew was there. And John was there. Mark might have been there. There are hints in the New Testament that Mark was from Jerusalem. And so Mark might have seen it, but Matthew saw it for sure, and John saw it for sure, and we know Luke's diligence in interviewing eyewitnesses about the things that he wrote and the things that he recorded, and Luke doesn't hesitate to say that Jesus died, that Jesus was dead. And then one other thing, two other things. One of them is you have the trained Roman soldiers who said he was dead. You know, these guys are familiar with death. They know what death is. Pilate is surprised when you read these accounts. We read them with Jeff's help. We read them together a few minutes ago in Mark's account. That Pilate is surprised that Jesus was already dead. Crucifixion usually took a lot longer than 6 hours. Some historians say that the average death by crucifixion took 30 to 36 hours to occur. There are documented accounts of crucifixions taking as long as 72 hours before the person actually expired. Jesus dies at the end of only 6. I've suggested before in other contexts, incidentally, I think that's a manifestation of the mercy and the love of God. As bad as that was, God shortened it considerably. For Jesus, only allowed him to be on the cross for 6 hours. Now, I'm not saying that made it any better necessarily, but it certainly shortened the time that he was suffering by a considerable amount. And so Pilate, he calls for the Romans. Are you sure he was dead? And their testimony is that he was dead. And after Pilate got that reassurance, he releases the body to Joseph of Arimathea for burial. And then You have the attempts, Matthew 28, Mark 15, John chapter 19. You have the attempts to cover up his death. And so Edwin Yamauchi said, even if we do not have the New Testament, we would be able to conclude from writings such as Josephus, the Talmud, the Tacitus, and Pliny the Younger, that he, Jesus, was crucified under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. And incidentally, the word crucified came to be used in Latin and Aramaic and Hebrew and Greek as a verb. If you were crucified, that means you were killed. Crucifixion and death were words that were used interchangeably. If you were to say to somebody, did you hear about Jesus? He was crucified last week. What they would understand you to be saying is he was killed. He was dead. And so We have a number of ways, and there are other eyewitnesses to this as well, to the fact that Jesus was raised, or that he was dead, that he actually died. We'll look at some of those in a little bit more detail tonight. I hope you can come back. There wasn't any way to present all of this material in one lesson. I'm going to have to really scramble to get it done in two. But the reason is because, again, this is the keystone. Everything you believe, everything I believe, everything you teach other people, everything I teach other people is prefaced on the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. If he really was raised from the dead, then it means something significant and important. It's not surprising. Take out your songbooks if you would. Brother Keister has selected number 487. Am I right about that, Rick? 487 is the song. If you'll have that open, we're going to sing an invitation song. When we gathered together around the Lord's table a few moments ago, we commemorated the death of Christ. His broken body was that memorial to that was the bread that we partook of, the unleavened bread. Unleavened bread, which would have been used when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper because he was partaking of the Passover feast. And when we drank the fruit of the vine, we were remembering that memorialized the blood of Christ. But it is in baptism that we memorialize the resurrection. And it's impossible to take the Lord's Supper without contemplating and thinking about what it led to, the resurrection. But the Lord's Supper, the elements, I'm not crazy about that term, but it's popularly or commonly understood. The materials that we use remind us that Christ died. In baptism, we memorialize the resurrection of Christ. Romans chapter 6. Jesus literally died. We die to sin, Paul says. He was buried, and that's what we will consider in the lesson tonight. We are buried. He rose. We rise from the waters of baptism in a new relationship with God. When each and every one of us, and that's the vast majority of the eyes into which I'm looking right now, when you were baptized, when I was baptized, we were reenacting the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus. And it is because Jesus was raised from the dead that that means that when you come up out of the waters of baptism, you have forgiveness of sins. Have you done that yet? Have you been baptized into Christ? Have you died to sin? Been buried in the waters of baptism? Been raised to walk in a new life? If not, then you have the opportunity, an incredible and a wonderful and a timely opportunity to do that this morning. We'll help you and assist you in dying to sin, burying that old man of sin and raising you up in a new relationship with God. If you've already done that and you have some other need that we can assist you with, then please come down to one of these front seats and let us help you. Whatever we can do to assist you to be what God would have you to be, let us know how we can help you right now while we stand and sing. We invite you to come.